This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
In which we read the boring stuff so you don't have to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 24th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know it feels like approximately forever ago, but travel back with me, if you would, to the early days of this month. May 3rd and 4th, the Tuesday and Wednesday, when the Federal Reserve, more precisely the Federal Open Market Committee, met to talk about what to do with this whole inflation thing. And look, even if you don't remember the meeting, which I get, you will remember what they voted for, right? A half a percentage point increase in the federal funds rate, trying to cool down the economy and get inflation under control, blah, blah, blah. You know all that. So why then, Kai, do you bring it up? Well, because tomorrow afternoon, we'll get the minutes from that meeting. And while they are not good book club fodder, Fed minutes, as Marketplace's Matt Levin explains, are worth paying attention to.
3 weeks after the Open Market Committee meeting, the Fed releases the minutes. And since those minutes come out in the afternoon East Coast time, Quincy Crosby at LPL Financial sometimes has to have an awkward conversation with Dunkin' Donuts employees.
You've got to explain to them that fresh coffee is better than coffee that's been sitting there for an hour.
Because she says the Fed minutes, a summary of the conversation, not the actual dialogue, are best paired with stimulants. Here's a reading.
In their assessment of the monetary policy stance necessary for achieving the committee's maximum employment and price stability goals, members...
A summer beach read, it's not. But Peter Conti Brown at the Wharton School says Fed minutes are deliberately written to be that way. It's kind of a code book.
If you know the code, then it's going to yield some insights. And if you don't, it looks like you're watching a James Bond movie and the spies are speaking to each other in a language that they intend for you not to understand.
Fed watchers are often scouring for clues that the committee consensus is more fragile than Chair Jay Powell lets on. Maybe some members want to raise rates faster or slower, or see inflation as more of a supply chain issue than too much demand.
Are we getting any kind of hint about big fissures and big fractures in the consensus that'll tell us that, you know, in the next few meetings, we're going to see some zigs and zags?
The minutes don't indicate who said what. In an era of live tweeting and live streaming, that may feel antiquated. But Bill English with the Yale School of Management says there's a reason the Fed doesn't just immediately post the actual transcript.
Then the meeting would become less of a serious meeting where people are learning from each other and potentially changing their minds.
The full transcripts do eventually come out 5 years after the meeting. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Believe me when I tell you that Mr. Levin just did us some public service journalism, because those minutes, oh boy, they're dry. Wall Street today, there was a whole lot of down until there was less down, except the NASDAQ. That was just down. Details, numbers, you know the drill. :03 this morning, I get a Slack from Andy Euler. It's a stock chart, because that's the way Marketplace Slack rolls, I guess, that shows energy companies are among the very few in the S&P 500 that are up this year over this time in 2021. And if you're somebody who's invested in energy stocks, you're saying, yeah, it's about time, because we had like a decade where things were pretty bad, right? Well, right, but We told you yesterday about how investors aren't really wanting to throw a bunch of money down on long-term projects like refineries in an industry that is, to boot, falling out of environmental favor. So, what gives with that chart? Here's Andy.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, that disrupted oil and gas supply. Now, on top of that, travel demand has returned to almost pre-pandemic levels. Together, we get high oil and natural gas prices. Great news for publicly traded energy companies.
This is the first time that energy companies have had a reason to smile since roughly 2014.
Stuart Glickman is an energy equity analyst at CFRA Research.
Oil prices have kind of fluctuated between mediocre and lousy for the better part of 7 years. So this is the first time that we've had $90 plus oil in a long time. And on top of that, natural gas is pretty frothy too.
Those years of lousiness led to investors getting burned. CEOs told them that the key to success in the energy space was maximizing production. That sentiment no longer prevails. Peter McNally is an energy analyst at the consultancy Third Bridge.
Volume didn't create value for shareholders, and now we're finding ourselves needing more volume, but the industry is not prepared and partly not willing to change how they invest.
More recently, big oil companies have been rewarding investors with dividends and stock buybacks instead of reinvesting that capital into expansion. Again, great news for energy industry investors. But Clark Williams Derry at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says not so much for the broader picture.
The better the oil and gas industry does, the worse the rest of the economy does.
He says it's certainly not that high oil and gas prices are the only reason that the rest of the stock market is down.
But high oil and gas prices filter into the rest of the economy. They raise the price of plastics. They raise the price of consumer products and manufacturing and transportation and electricity.
He says another way of putting it, high energy prices act as a sort of tax on the rest of the economy. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I'll tell you one phrase on my own personal Fed Minutes bingo card for tomorrow. Supply chain. Yes, perhaps that's an easy win, but come on, you know, you take them where you can get them. As of noon yesterday, there were 28 container ships waiting to unload at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, a record low for the past couple of years, but still unfathomably high when compared to the before times when the backlog down there was typically zero or maybe one. Supply chain strain is the part of the inflation story in this economy that higher interest rates and the Federal Reserve are just not going to be able to fix. Rachel Premack lives and breathes supply chain. She's the editorial director at FreightWaves, and she pointed out in a story the other day that there is a certain something about the way stuff moves around the global economy that needs a second look as well. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
So the very first line of the piece you wrote the other day that caught our ear and made us get you on the phone was, and this is a quote, "I hate big boats and so should you." Explain.
Yeah, so you really cannot talk about our messed up supply chain situation without talking about megaships. You know, these container ships have gotten bigger and bigger throughout the decades, but port sizes have not kept up with the size of these ships. So that's how we have a situation right now, what's going on at the port of Long Beach, yeah. Los Angeles, that we've seen this past year and a half. That's really the only port that can handle a lot of large container ships. And as a result, there's so much congestion there because there are really no other ports that can handle a large amount of container ships.
Give me a sense of how much bigger the mega ships of today are than, I don't know, the ships of like 10 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, so from 2012 to today, the largest ship class, you could say, of a given year, it's actually increased from 50% over the past 10 years.
Half
and it's increased
again
by
is big.
Sixfold from 1981 to today. Sorry.
Yeah, so in 10 years, half again is big and sixfold since in the last 40 years.
Yes, yes.
Well, look, I mean, hang on a minute. If I'm running a shipping business, I'm thinking I want big. I want economies of scale. I want to fit a zillion of those containers on so I only have to run one crew and one ship. It seems to make sense for the shipping companies.
It does seem to make sense, but these ships are so expensive that ocean carriers literally cannot afford to pay off the loans to have these ships running. And the ships are so big that they can't even fill these mega ships on their own. As a result, you see more and more ocean carriers forming alliances with each other just to fill their own ships. It's decreased competition because you have three alliances dominating the entire ocean carrier market, and that's has a lot of implications for global trade.
Yeah, price-wise, for sure. They call themselves alliances. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration calls them cartels. My guess is, no matter what you call them, they are making plenty of money.
Yes, yes. This past year and a half, they have been, and some of these companies have been made more money in the past year than they did in the past 10 years, just because trade has gone way up. The 10 largest ocean carrier companies all decided about 15 or 20 years ago, okay, let's all build these giant ships. Mm-hmm. As a result, they flooded the market with ocean shipping capacity, but demand stayed the same. So, you know, supply went way up, demand stayed the same, and they saw rates really collapse in the past 10 years. And COVID really saved them, for sure.
So, and of course, what that translates into, by the way, COVID saving them, is that businesses are paying more to get their goods from wherever to wherever because the rates are higher. But also, eventually, finally, consumers are having to pay more.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. It's we've seen unprecedentedly high shipping rates this past year and a half, and that has had a marked effect on inflation.
Eventually, the supply backlog that we're all enjoying now will ease. Rates will come down. All that capacity will not be needed. But these ships will still be big and out there because we're not going to go back to smaller ships, are we?
No. So it looks like for the next few years, many of these ocean carriers are thinking, okay, maybe we went too far with these ships. And it is a problem when you think about the fact that trade volumes will eventually decline and they will be stuck with these giant ships that they might not be able to fill.
Rachel Premack, she's the editorial director at FreightWaves, talking about big boats. Rachel, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Make it profitable again?
Yeah, easier said than done, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 48 points today, about a 10%, 31,928. The NASDAQ, as I said, went the other way, down 270 points, 2.3%, 11,264. The S&P 500 down 32 points, 0.8%, 39.41. Andy Euler was telling us a little bit about why energy stocks have been rising lately. A couple of big names in that sector stayed on trend today. ExxonMobil revved up about 0.5%. The coal company Peabody Energy found 1.3%. Big thumbs down today for social media companies, thus the NASDAQ plummeting, right? Snap led the way. It was down 43%. After the company said it's not going to meet its targets, other social media companies clicked down as well. Facebook parent Meta unplugged 7.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lost, I think, in the flurry of coverage about COVID vaccines for going on, a year and a half now, is an antibody treatment called Evusheld. Came out about 6 months ago. AstraZeneca makes it. It's designed to stop the virus from infecting people with weak immune systems, people for whom the much more talked about vaccines often don't work. Like the vaccines at first, the FDA has approved Evusheld for emergency use, and the federal government is in charge of buying and distributing it. But as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, there has been a disconnect between the amount of Evusheld the government has bought and how much is getting to the people who need it.
Marsha Boyce suffers from a blood cancer called chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. The drugs she takes for her condition suppress her immune system. So, after getting the COVID vaccine, she got tested to see if she had antibodies.
For me personally, I had zero. So after the two vaccines and a booster, I had still zero protection from COVID. I was upset.
Evusheld works by delivering those antibodies directly. Boyce heard about it on a CLL Facebook group, then started one on Evusheld.
Everybody was talking about it and, you know, couldn't wait to get it.
But it wasn't available at her hospital in Illinois. She started looking for it in Florida, where she spends her winters.
In the beginning, there were only four places in Florida that had it. I called all of them and they only were doing it for their patients.
She finally found a place.
The small clinic down near Fort Lauderdale. And I was able to get my doses down there.
Turns out that small private clinic had gotten more Evusheld doses than any other provider in Florida, including some of the state's largest hospitals. NYU transplant surgeon Dori Segev says that's not an isolated case.
The rollout of Evusheld has been complicated, confusing, and frustrating for many people.
Segev says from the beginning, the math didn't add up. The Biden administration ordered 1.7 million doses for the more than 7 million Americans who were immunocompromised. And yet, by some estimates, around three quarters of those Evusheld doses may have gone unused. Segev blames a lack of outreach.
There were no centralized efforts to educate patients, their providers, and as a result, many providers who take care of immunocompromised people were not aware that this even existed.
In a statement, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services confirms it has more Evusheld available than is being requested by states and territories, which send it to local hospitals and clinics. And a spokesperson acknowledges that getting the treatment to people has been challenging. This unequal distribution has led some healthcare systems to ration the treatment. The University of Michigan's Dr. Daniel Call says at first, his hospital ranked patients based on who needed it the most and set up lotteries.
That obviously creates a whole new workflow about identifying those patients and offering it to them in a random fashion.
Call says that randomness has helped ensure fairness.
So that you're not maybe prioritizing people who are most educated and are therefore calling up and requesting it.
The labor in this new workflow has fallen to people like the University of Pennsylvania's Dr. Amy Payne, who specializes in a rare autoimmune disease that can cause fatal blistering. Its treatment can wipe out a large part of the immune system, so the COVID vaccine doesn't appear to give her patients full protection.
Some of them agreed immediately. Some of them had additional questions. Some of them wanted to talk to their families about it. And then I would call them back a second time to go over it.
Things got more complicated in February when the FDA decided that each recipient should get two doses of Evusheld. Overnight, the number of people originally slated to get help was cut by half. Health professionals are trying to help. Nicholas Torney, a clinical pharmacist in Traverse City, Michigan, says his team has created a toolkit
for providers to understand the who, what, where, when, and why about this medication. And also for nurses and pharmacists related to how to actually order the medication.
AstraZeneca tells Marketplace it has more Evusheld on hand if the government wants to buy it. The Biden administration says it needs funding from Congress to do that. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
$3.7 million babies, give or take, were born in this country last year. That's about a 1% increase over 2020, so said the CDC this morning. It's the first bump in the birth rate in this economy since 2014, though it should be said that that 2014 increase was a blip. Other than that, the birth rate's been declining pretty much steadily since 2007, about which two things. One, obviously, this is an amazingly personal decision, right? And number two, it's also a labor market story. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
It feels a little weird to talk about the very personal decisions people make about having kids as an economic indicator. But there is a connection between the economy and birth rates.
We see that historically. We see that basically in every past recession. Births fell.
Philip Levine is an economics professor at Wellesley College. He says we saw the same thing in 2020 during the pandemic recession. The birth rate fell 4%. But then
the economy recovered extremely quickly.
And we now know the birth rate bounced back pretty quickly too, though not all the way.
What's interesting is the pattern that we see in terms of the age groups.
Brady Hamilton is at the National Center for Health Statistics at the CDC and worked on the report. He says in 2021, the birth rate fell for teenagers and women in their early to mid-20s, but rose for women in their late 20s and up. The biggest increase happened for women in their late 30s.
Noteworthy, the birth rates for women 35 to 39 was up 5%.
That makes sense to Emily Johnston at the Urban Institute. She says older people who knew they wanted kids might have put off trying for a little while early in the pandemic.
But if they ultimately were seeking to have a child in the near future, they may have delayed a year and then decided now's the time for me.
Big picture, Philip Levine at Wellesley says the slight increase in the birth rate last year will likely just be a blip. Overall, there's still a downward trend.
What's going on with COVID and the baby bust and then rebound is interesting, but much less important than this longer term decline.
Which he says has significant implications for things like the future of Social Security and the broader economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The National Association of Business Economics released a survey this week in which slower economic growth and possibly slower inflation figured prominently. There was some data from NABE last month, though, that we want to tell you about, specifically their business conditions survey, which for April showed a majority of companies expect their profit margins will be pretty much unchanged over the next 3 months, which is related to this, that 45% of companies are passing on some of their cost increases to their customers because they have to. Uli Nasibova, who we've had on the show a couple of times, runs a gelateria here in Los Angeles.
Business has been rough for my shop specifically, primarily because of my locations. I used to rely on a lot of foot traffic outside of my stores, and I've seen permanent reduction in foot traffic. And I say permanent because it's been 2 years since the start of the pandemic, and the foot traffic, while some of it has recovered, it's nowhere close to the 2019 levels. I had to pause the subscription service because I was waiting on a lot of the supplies, paper and shipping supplies, to ship my products. I have recently had to raise my prices a little bit because gas and then every single item went up in cost. You know, we see things like 50 to 60%, sometimes 100% doubling of certain items that we use. And I staved off price increases for as long as I could. And then there came a time, literally a few months ago, where I just couldn't keep doing it anymore. Sometimes my husband jokes that I'm running a gelato nonprofit, and it certainly does feel that way. But one of the best things that I can do for my business is make it profitable again. And I can't be running a nonprofit anymore. So I raised my prices ever so slightly. I think the biggest surprise for me was how during the pandemic, I went from being terrified and sad about the future of the business to pivoting it to something new and better. It was awful, but at the same time, I had more time on my hands to work on several projects that I have been putting off all these years. I finally did a rebrand. I finally was able to focus on creating packaging for each individual flavor. I taught myself a lot of the Photoshop and Illustrator on YouTube. So it was just like reacquainting myself with every single flavor story all over again.
Thank you. Ulina Sabova there. She is the proprietor of Uli's Gelato right here in Los Angeles. Final note on the way out today, in which somehow and incomprehensibly I have to repeat myself, and not for the first time. At the end of this program on December the 14th, 2012, the day of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary, I pointed out that there are more places to buy a firearm in this economy than there are Starbucks on the entire planet. And with the news out of Texas this afternoon that at least 15 people have been killed at an elementary school there, we looked up the latest numbers, it's still true. And I honestly don't know where we go from here. Okay, that's it. Not much else to say, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.